This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, joining me on the Jodcast today is Dr. Stephen Sargent from the Open University. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast.
Hello and thanks for having me.
Oh, it's brilliant. Now, you work on extragalactic surveys of star-forming galaxies. Could you tell me a bit about your research and how you do these surveys?
Sure. Well, I use a lot of space telescope data. So people think of space telescopes as just the Hubble Space Telescope. In fact, that's far from being the case. There are lots of space telescopes. I've used the Akari Space Telescope, a Japanese one. And I'm using now the Herschel Space Observatory, and it's the biggest telescope in space. It's got the biggest mirror of any telescope in space. And with it, we're painting the sky. We're doing the widest field survey that we can with it. It's actually, we're mapping 1% of the sky, and we're looking for bright galaxies bursting with star formation. So we're looking for the formation of galaxies like our Milky Way right out to almost all the way back to the Big Bang. And it's Herschel is fantastically sensitive. It's been a really, really good mission. So we're awash with data. And it's a great time to be in astronomy when you're just so awash with data. So, so we're having a great time.
And you have two main goals in this survey that you're interested in yourself. The working on quasars, and you're also working on gravitational lensing. So, shall we start off with the quasars, and you can tell us what is a quasar and why you're excited by them?
Sure. Well, a quasar is a black hole in the centre of a galaxy. And this black hole is drawing in matter from this surrounding galaxy, and the matter is falling into the black hole, and by the friction that's generated in the accretion disk that's forming around the black hole, it gets very, very hot. And so it's one of these strange paradoxes that you have the darkest thing in the universe that we know of, a black hole, surrounded by some of the brightest stuff that we know of in the universe. So you this accretion disk can outshine the whole of the rest of the galaxy. So we look for these bright points where the black holes are accreting, and that's telling us where the activity is, where the black holes are growing. But there is a mystery associated with these black holes that we haven't yet unpicked, and that's one thing that I'm hoping that the Herschel Space Telescope will be able to tell us about. And that's the black hole properties are very closely connected to the properties of the galaxy that they're in. So the black hole mass is a fraction of a percent of the bulge of a spiral galaxy that it's in, or the elliptical galaxy that it's in. And yet, despite being a fraction of a percent, and a tiny, tiny fraction of the volume, it's very closely correlated. The masses are very closely correlated with properties of the wider galaxy. So something closely connected the growth of that black hole with the growth, the formation of the galaxy around it. So what we're hoping to do with Herschel is we want to find places where the black holes are growing. So we're finding places where we're seeing this bright accretion around black holes. And we're measuring the star formation rates in those quasars. So we want to see how and why there are these close, mysterious connections between the masses of black holes and the properties of the wider galaxies. And we think that Herschel will give us a lot of really useful clues about how this process is working.
Now, galaxies like our Milky Way, for example, go through several periods of star formation. Do these galaxies also have the same properties? And do you look at the first star formation? Is that what relates to the black hole mass, or is it all the star formation in the galaxy?
Actually, that's a really good and really deep question. We don't know a lot about how many times quasars turn on. One picture could be that there'll be just a very small number of very rare events that last a fair amount of time each. Or another picture of they're very, very frequent times that a quasar is on. And we don't know a lot about when star formation is going on, so how often the star formation is going on. So, but I think the likely thing is that they go essentially hand in hand, and there'll be a handful of really key events where there's a lot of black hole growth and a lot of star formation going on in the host galaxy, and we'll be picking out just those few epochs in galaxies throughout most of the history of the universe.
And do you have any leading theories of what relates the star formation to the black hole growth?
Yeah, there are actually lots of theories. In fact, it's a really complicated physical process because you've got so much going on. You've got such a range of scales, and you've got such a lot of stuff going on because you can generate winds from this central accreting black hole that can be blowing out the gas, or maybe the gas could be encountering other gas and then coming shocking and triggering more star formation. So actually, in principle, it could go either way. Unpicking the physics of how the black hole accretion is suppressing or enhancing star formation, it's very difficult because of the wide range of scales. Even in star formation, it's very hard to figure out what the triggers are and what the ratios of the low mass objects to the high mass objects are, and it's what we call the initial mass function. It's just the physics of just star formation on its own is very, very hard. And unpicking how the quasar, the black hole accretion affects it is very, very complicated. So actually what we really need are observational constraints. And that's the key thing that we're missing at the moment. And if we can find out how these things are linked, then we get a better handle. And in fact, we do have some early results already. We're finding that the star formation in quasars is not linearly correlated with the black hole accretion. So if you have a black hole that's accreting twice as much, you don't get twice as much star formation, you get a bit less. And that's already disagreeing with some theoretical models for how this feedback process is working. So it's early stages yet, and so we're hoping that Herschel will give us a lot more useful insights as time goes on.
So again, that's really exciting how the star formation rate is linked to the growth, but it's not a one-to-one correlation. So there must be some other process happening that is causing this difference.
It's wonderful to be at a time when a project is making lots and lots of new discoveries. And it's a really exciting time in far infrared and submillimeter astronomy now, because these facilities are making a whole bunch of discovery space accessible to us. A whole bunch of discoveries have only just become possible. So it's very, very exciting. And the quasar science is only one sort of science that we're doing with Herschel. The other big thing that we're very interested in at where I work is gravitational lensing. Now, what's happening here is that... okay, so you're probably sitting in a chair listening to this, right? I mean, we're sitting in chairs here. Everyone is curving the space-time around them. So sitting in your chair right now, you are curving the space-time around you right now. But it's tiny, tiny effects. It's very, very difficult to measure. It's, in fact, for a human, it's impossible to measure. But for a giant astronomical object like the Sun, for example, or a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, you can detect this warping. And in fact, you can even take an image of a cluster of galaxies, and you can see the background galaxies that you're seeing through this foreground cluster. They look warped and stretched and pulled into arcs. And why they're pulled into arcs? Well, the reason is that the foreground cluster is warping the space and time around it. So you're seeing the warping of space and time by looking at these distant it's called gravitational lensing. And what we're doing with Herschel is to find these strong gravitational lenses, and we've found a really powerful way of doing it.
This goes, what is this exciting way?
Well, the trick is that very bright, very luminous star-forming galaxies are very, very rare, and we can exploit that fact. There are lots of piddly little things. There are very, very few super bright ones. So if you see a super bright one, chances are that there's something else going on. So what we think is happening is you've got a piddly little one that's being boosted by this gravitational lensing effect. So what we're finding is we're painting the sky, looking for these very bright, bright, bright star-forming galaxies. And the ones that we see, these are strong gravitational lenses. These are like cosmic telescopes, because because the gravitational lensing, it makes them brighter. It also stretches the images, so we're getting a sharper view of the background, distant universe. It's also brighter, so that we can study them much, much more easily. So this is a fabulous new technique.
Without this effect of the gravitational lenses, would we be able to see these galaxies that are so far away in the background that are being beamed towards us?
Yes, but it's terribly hard, because they're intrinsically much fainter. And there are surveys that are trying to do this. I mean, there are projects that are trying to do this. I don't want to belittle the excellent work that they're doing, but by exploiting this strong gravitational lensing of these far infrared galaxies, we can probe this distant galaxy population in a way that's never been possible before, at least for far infrared and submillimeter galaxies. And so this has been the big breakthrough that we've had. You see, it's been very, very hard work finding these strong gravitational lenses. And we're here at in Manchester, and this is the Jodcast, and one of the fantastic results from Jodrell Bank has been the gravitational lens survey. And this has been a really hard piece of work, trawling through tens of thousands of galaxies, looking for those rare few that are strong gravitational lenses. And it's been and it's a fantastic achievement by the Jodrell Bank, the CLAS survey, is what it's called. So what we've found is that with Herschel, we don't have to sift through tens of thousands. We can get basically 100% selection efficiency. So in our first five candidates, we found all five were strong gravitational lenses. And this was, you know, fantastic, fantastic results. We were very, very excited by this. And so our plan is, this is something we're collaborating with guys here in Jodrell Bank and elsewhere, is to use the new eMerlin telescope array to follow up these strong gravitational lenses. And so we'll unpick and see what's going on in these very distant galaxies at much sharper resolution than would otherwise be possible. So it's a really powerful new technique for finding these submillimeter galaxies, so we're very excited.
I have a question about this strong lensing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some places in planet hunting, they use gravitational lensing to detect a planet, and they say you can't go back and look again. How come in the strong lensing effect, you can go back and do follow-up surveys?
Right. Yeah, that's because with these planet surveys, what you've got is you've got some background star, and you've got some foreground thing that's just drifting in front. And as it just lines up perfectly, the foreground star or planet or whatever is gravitationally boosting the background thing. But then it drifts away again. Now you could, if you knew the direction that it was going in, and you had a spaceship or something, you could go and you could reobserve. But that's, you know, we're kind of short of spaceships, so it's kind of tricky. But I mean, you could in principle. I mean, have been proposed, I think, for one interplanetary mission, could in principle have reobserved a microlens planet observation. But these are rare opportunities, so it's pretty tricky. But with our galaxies, the relative motion's very, very, very slow. So we've got plenty of time to go back. You know, it's eons that it would take. And it's kind of handy because then we have the opportunity to make these exquisitely high-resolution images that we would otherwise be completely inaccessible to us.
The light from these images have all been distorted in the gravitational lens.
Mm-hmm.
How do you put all that back together to get rid of the foreground object, I assume, is get corrupting your light? Mm-hmm. Is there a way for you to do that, to see properly what the galaxy is like?
Yeah, actually, nature of these background galaxies is helping us because they are submillimeter wave detected galaxies. It turns out that these galaxies are very, very dusty because it's dust that is radiating this far infrared light. This dust also makes the galaxies very red in optical light. So if you look in optical light, basically all that you're seeing are these foreground objects. But when you shift into the infrared light, you see the background galaxy appear. It's looking at the differences between what you're seeing in the optical and what you're seeing in the infrared that give you the handle as to what's background and what's foreground. So we've been taking data with the Keck telescopes, and even with this gigantic Keck telescope, we still couldn't detect anything at all from our background lensed galaxies. But when we looked at it with the infrared camera on the Hubble Space Telescope, then we've seen some absolutely exquisite, beautiful lens configurations, beautiful Einstein rings that are... Yes, it's been very, very exciting seeing these things.
And you've seen these like 20 hours ago for the first time.
Yeah, yeah,
like
that, my, haven't you? Yes, yes.
So very up to date on this.
Very, very up to date. So my as a guy working at the Open University, Matty Negrella, who has just presented these in a conference in California, just yesterday, in fact, and today I'm presenting them at George Rollback at the University of Manchester.
That's fantastic. So what is an Einstein ring? Is that just the lensing? Can you describe these images a bit?
Yeah, sure, of course. Well, imagine that you've got a foreground object and you've got a background object exactly lined up behind it. Okay, so the question is, what would you see? Well, there's a symmetry argument that if your foreground thing is symmetrical, circularly symmetric, and your background thing is circularly symmetric, say, then the image that you see has to be circularly symmetric because, and there's nothing in this configuration to give it any preferred direction. And so there has to be a ring shape. So the background object, which is some background splodge, will be stretched into a circle around this foreground object. And this stretching into a circle is exactly what we're seeing with these Hubble Space Telescope data that we've literally just hot off the press.
They're absolutely fantastic data. The images are, it's hard to say on a podcast like this just how fantastic an image actually is, but I'm sure we'll try and find a way to show you that image eventually, at least.
Yep, when we can, when we publish it, and we'll do a press release image, and we'll certainly pass it on to you so you can host it on whatever web pages you like.
The lens object, I was looking on this image you showed in your talk today, is 11 billion years ago in the past, or something like that, whereas the galaxy, what's doing the lensing, is 3 billion years ago, which is a massive difference.
Mm.
What's quite surprising is those objects in the past, so far away, are producing stars. Are these objects still producing stars now? I mean, it's 11 billion years ago.
Ah, now that's a really good question, and we think that the star formation will happen in bursts, so probably that burst won't have lasted for that long, and so it will have died away, and maybe have a few more bursts in the meantime. But the really subtle thing is that whether it's the same object, because what's happening is that galaxies are colliding with galaxies and merging. So right now, our galaxy has galaxies that are orbiting it and being drawn in. So it's accreting the Magellanic Cloud galaxies, and we ourselves are falling towards the Andromeda Galaxy. And in 4 or 10 billion years, we'll collide, and there'll be some combined giant galaxy that we make. So let's suppose that there's some astronomer in the distant future. They see our galaxy, they'll see the Andromeda Galaxy, and then someone asks the question, "Well, are these galaxies still forming stars?" But by the time that they're observing it, we'll have merged and merged again and probably merged again with other things. And so it becomes quite difficult to say to track the identity of an object through cosmic time like that. So it's a surprisingly complicated and subtle question. It's about the merger history of galaxies, the star formation history of galaxies. And just even expressing it in words becomes quite tricky.
And are these galaxies like what our Milky Way is now? Are these spirals, or can you tell anything like about them?
It's early days with our lens reconstruction, but they're certainly resolved into knots of star formation, and there's structure there that we're seeing. So they're probably the progenitors of elliptical galaxies, but that doesn't mean that they're going to look elliptical at these redshifts. They're going to look like something else.
And also, you showed us in your talk, these objects have water lines and CO lines.
Yes, there's been a very nice result from Alain Aumont detecting water from Plateau de Burr in these distant galaxies. What you can tell is you can learn about the environment that the molecules are in. You can learn about the densities of the gas. You can learn about how many ionizing photons they're seeing, what sort of environment they're in. And the interesting thing is that from this spectroscopic data, from these emission lines that we're seeing, it looks like there's an active nucleus in there. So there is an accreting black hole lurking inside this otherwise star-forming galaxy. So this is another example of how useful the gravitational lensing is that it's much easier to do these observations because of the boosting that this gravitational lensing has given us.
Brilliant. What's next?
Well, we will be releasing, we already have released some data to the public. And by the public, I mean generally the astronomical community, but anyone can download data from the Herschel Space Telescope. And we have reduced images. You can have a great swathe of the sky that you can now see. And we've got images tailored for the public as well. So GIFs and JPEGs, that sort of thing. So there's a lot to rummage, and we'll be making more and more data releases as the survey goes on that anyone can download. So go have a play, do please.
Oh, lovely pictures. That's mm-hmm. the great thing about astronomy. You get to see so many pretty pictures, and well, you've got loads with ice diamonds and everything. In gravitational lensing, you're mm-hmm. looking quite far back in terms of time and the early. You're close to the earlier universe, aren't you?
Mm. Well, actually, it's one of the amazing things that you can see galaxies through most of the history of the universe. In fact, all right, I contend that cosmologists are much luckier than particle physicists, let's say. Okay, so if you're a particle physicist, you could ask a question, a really fundamental, important, engaging question that could be completely impossible to answer. So if you're interested in M theory or superstring theory or something, your really fundamental, interesting questions could be completely inaccessible to experiment. You need gigantic, galactic-sized particle accelerators to do it. And there's no chance you would ever be able to do that. But in cosmology, you can see galaxies nearly all the way back to the Big Bang. And that, to me, is absolutely staggering that is possible, that it's technologically feasible, that it's affordable, that we can do it at all is just stunning. I think we have a real privilege to be doing cosmology and to have the accessible questions. And also, right now is a really fantastic, exciting time in cosmology, because all of the big questions that you could ask about the fate of the universe, the content of the universe, how all of the galaxies came and together and formed, where all the spiral disks came from, and how the bulges of spirals came about, and how the links to the black holes in the centres, where it all came from. All of these fundamental questions are being answered right now, so it's a fantastically exciting time in cosmology right now.
Well, following on from that, if from the Big Bang, there's just the building blocks of matter, and there's no stars or anything like that. But suddenly you see these galaxies appearing. Mm-hmm. How did they suddenly, be there?
Yeah, that's a really deep question. It's what generated the first light in the universe? So you have the early universe. The universe eventually is expanding, becomes transparent. It's dark. There's nothing in it. Just gas. And then the gas condenses down and forms the first stars and the first galaxies. So, I mean, gravity is the reason that these things happen, is that it just needs slight perturbations from uniformity. It's very unstable to form in clumps of stuff. And so stuff falls together and forms the first stars and the first galaxies. But as to what they looked like, the very, very first luminous things in the universe, we still don't know. And we'll have to wait for telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope to give us the first insights. Also the Square Kilometre Array, when that comes, that will give us the first insights.
So, wow, these lens objects that are 11 billion years ago aren't even close to being the first objects. There's a long way to go yet.
They're very early, and they are most of the way to the Big Bang. But there is this small window of time when the very, very first things... as a fraction of the history of the universe, it's a really tiny shard, but it's a really interesting tiny shard at the very, very earliest times, and we'll be probing that with the next generation of facilities, and that's, as I say, it's a fantastically exciting time.
Another part of your life is you're a science consultant for Bang Goes the Theory and other TV shows.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Can you tell us, what do you do, and how do you come up with concepts?
Oh, right, well, what we do, I'm... leading a team. It's not just me. I'm leading a team of about a dozen people who are consulting on this Bang Goes the Theory TV show. The first thing we do is check that stuff is working. The scripts that they're going to be talking through are factually correct. And we can also give them pointers on where the hot science is, because the BBC, the broadcasters, are not scientists themselves. So they ask us, you know, what's hot, where's stuff going, where are the exciting areas. Although, of course, the BBC have the editorial say. I mean, it's quite right that we ourselves are not broadcasters. So. But so we check for factual errors, and mostly it works out and stuff doesn't slip through. But there have been a few things that have been not quite perfect, but hey, it's telly. It's telly, and it's brilliant telly. It's really, really good. And what I really love is that, especially actually with the most recent series, Bang Goes the Theory, is you've got a... It's the studio discussions. That's what I really like. Is you have intelligent people talking intelligently about scientific topics at a time which is opposite Coronation Street. And that's just fantastic. I mean, it's what the... I mean, you could say it's what the BBC is for. It's just... brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant that it's bringing science in a completely accessible way to a very, very, to a huge audience. Yeah. Millions and millions of people. So it's wonderful being involved in that.
And do you have any favourite ideas? Have you come up with any of the ideas for the show?
Yes, some. I can't say too much because there'll be stuff that'll be broadcast a little bit later. So we're in discussions already now about the series 5 of Bang Goes the Theory, and I like the way that the series has grown. It's now got a lot more. It doesn't need to be showy or to impress. It's now a really thoughtful and interesting content. Particularly in the last series, there was an item on genetically modified foods, and that was really thoughtful, engaging content. And there's more on. I can't go into the details on that, but I mean, there's astronomy is something they're particularly interested in on Bang Goes the Theory. So I keep watching.
I feel like I should be on Doctor Who now and saying spoilers or something.
Spoiler alert!
Spoilers. And have you had any really favourite things that's been on the show?
Well, in series one, they got Marek Kakula and flung him around, in, or Marek was flinging around one of the presenters in a dark matter demonstration. That was that was kind of fun to watch.
Oh, fantastic! Oh, it sounds like such an exciting thing to be able to consult on a TV show as popular as that. I mean, it's a fantastic show. I love it.
Yeah, it's broadcasting has a very different set of intellectual values. It's wonderful to be involved in that, such as an alien intellectual discipline as brocasting. And in fact, Jogcast too. It's brilliant.
Do you know what? It's been an absolute pleasure being on the Jogcast. It's been fascinating. It's brilliant.
Right. Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.